You're listening to Idaho Matters on Boise State Public Radio News. I'm Gemma Caudette, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We've got a lot to get you updated on today. So our panel today includes Kevin Richer, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, our own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Kalama Hines, reporter with EastIdahoNews.com. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Hello, Gemma.
So I do want to start today talking about the legislature. And just a few days in, Jimmy, and a big topic being discussed is abortion, but in particular, funding in cities, correct? And how this is tied to abortion.
Yeah, that's right. And we certainly expect to see a whole lot more bills related to abortion. But the first one out of the gate would essentially withhold a city or county or whatever local government entity it might be, withholding sales tax money that gets distributed by the state to these local entities if they refuse to comply with Idaho's criminal abortion statute. So specifically, I'm thinking of Boise, which its city council last July passed a resolution that would refuse to prioritize or fund investigations into criminal abortions. So that potentially could put it at odds if this bill becomes a law. And we're talking about $24 million is what Boise is expecting to get from the sales tax distribution this fiscal year, which is about 8% of its projected revenue. So, I mean, not a small chunk of change at all.
Have we heard from the city of Boise about this, Jimmy, and their thoughts at all?
So I did reach out to the Mayor Lauren McClain's office, and a spokesperson there basically said that, yeah, we're watching it. We expect a whole lot of bills to be introduced surrounding this issue, plus a lot of other things that the city's interested in. But they really didn't have any sort of substantive comment. So I can't imagine that they are supportive of this, since that resolution came from Lauren McClain's office.
And what has been the reaction from lawmakers about this bill? Has anyone come out in favor of it, opposed to it?
Oh, I mean, you have House Speaker Mike Moyle signed on as one of the co-sponsors. Several co-sponsors are listed on the bill itself. And you did have at least one Democrat who was in the House State Affairs Committee where it was introduced earlier this week, Democratic Representative John Gannon. He said basically, this is premature because there's also another component to this bill where if a public employee at a city or county decides to contract with any sort of organization that provides abortions, even if they're contracting for something else that's not abortions, they could face a felony charge. And he's basically saying, look, we still have this federal lawsuit over Idaho's criminal abortion statute ongoing. It has not been settled yet. We just got the state Supreme Court decision regarding the legality of it that needs to be sifted through and sort of, interpreted, figured out where the lines are. And he said that, sure, maybe this bill could come later this session. You should probably hold on to it. But for right now, things are too murky to kind of make a decision one way or the other.
Well, and as you said, Jimmy, this is probably the first of numerous bills we're going to see this session in regards to abortion here in Idaho.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, we kind of heard from the governor even, as well as some Republican leaders saying that things might need to be cleaned up with regard to, for example, there are three exceptions for abortions to be performed in cases of rape, incest, or if the life of the mother is at risk. Domestic violence advocates are saying that rape and incest exception is not really an exception because you need a police report and you can't actually get that for months or years until that is public information, so essentially moot. So I expect to see something like that. But also on the flip side of that, more conservative, hardline Republicans want to eliminate all of those exceptions. The state Republican Party platform wants to, just criminalize the entire process or procedure of abortion. So I certainly expect to see those bills coming in the next, you know, few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate your time, Jimmy. I know you have to run, so appreciate you talking to us about this, and I know we will continue the conversation. So thanks for that.
Of course. Thanks, Gemma.
And I want to stay with the legislature for a bit longer because, Clark, I know that you've been really focused on the legislature this week, in particular, the State of the State address, but also about JFAC. This is the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee. And man, Clark, it is changing.
Yeah, it certainly is. This is one of the largest, most powerful committees in the entire legislature. It's the budget committee. They control the purse strings. And so there's a lot of influence and scrutiny that comes along with that. But it's a 20-member committee. It's got members of both the House and the Senate, which is a little bit unusual. And it meets every day, every morning, first thing at 8 a.m. to go through and set each element of the state's budget, which is almost $5 billion with a B, dollars. This is a really important committee. It's going to be closely watched. And like you said, there's a ton of changes for JFAC. Each of the leaders, each of the chairpersons of the committee is a new chair this year. And so that on the House side, that's Representative Wendy Horman, a Republican from Idaho Falls. And on the Senate side, that's Senator Scott Groh, who's a Republican from the Treasure Valley. I can't remember if it's Eagle or Meridian, but Western Ada County there. So you've got two new members, two new chairs, rather, for the committee. You also have 12 of the 20 members on JFAC weren't on the committee last year. And so they had their first meeting of the year Tuesday, and the chairs basically warned them that you have a huge workload in front of you, and this will be different than any other committee that you serve on this year. They're actually gearing up to set 108 different budgets. And wow, they're hoping to do that by the end of March, which is when the legislature would like to adjourn. The work really starts in earnest next week. On Tuesday, you have the largest budget hearing for the state. That's the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare budget hearing. And they're going to specifically look at the Medicaid budget, which is something that Republican legislative leaders have signaled in the last week that they really want to take a look at Medicaid expansion, which Idaho voters approved via ballot initiative back in 2018. Republicans are saying we're 5 years in, we have an opportunity to review Medicaid expansion. They said they're concerned about the cost of the Medicaid budget, and Republican leaders, including new House Speaker Mike Moyle and Senate President Pro Tem Chuck Winder, have said that it's not even off the table for them to consider reversing Medicaid expansion, which again, the Democrats immediately responded and said, hold on now, we cannot just strip healthcare coverage to people. And we need to keep in mind that this is something that more than 60% of Idaho voters approved at the ballot box in 2018. And so right off the bat, next Tuesday morning, JFAC is going to have a hearing on health and welfare's budget and the Medicaid budget, especially. And that really kicks off 6 weeks of daily budget hearings where JFAC is going to go through each aspect of the state budget. They're going to have agency directors come in and testify, department heads come in and testify, elected officials come in and talk about their budget request and begin the process of putting together this giant state budget, which is really the one thing that drives the length of the session. Really, one of the only requirements of the Idaho legislature when it comes to the Constitution, I can think of two big ones, providing fair, equitable, uniform public schools, our public school system, and then passing a balanced budget every year. Those are really the two big requirements that the legislature has faced, and the budget really drives the length of the session and a lot of the discussions in the session. So it's kind of like buckle up with new leadership in JFAC, 12 new members that weren't on the committee, 108 different budget bills, already a lot of scrutiny around state spending. And so really buckle up. But that's going to be one of the committees that I'm going to try and watch closely throughout this year is JFAC for sure.
Well, in particular, Clark, I think with all of the changes to it, right? I mean, the new members and how all of that could play out.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't know enough about some of these new members and where they stand and how they're going to vote. We don't know if it's going to be more difficult to get, say, a Medicaid budget out of the JFAC committee or a public schools budget out of the JFAC committee or a higher education budget out of the JFAC committee. So we're going to be learning a lot about these new members and the role they play. And we do know there's several conservative new members of the committee who are going to be looking to scrutinize these budgets. And so with those, all the changes, and change is a theme overall with this year's legislature, top to bottom, leadership, all of the committees are experiencing changes because we had massive turnover last year between the primary election and then the redistricting process that took place before that. And just quite simply, redistricting was using the new census population data to redraw the state's political boundaries to ensure that representation was as equal as possible. But that led to massive changes in turnover all throughout the legislature, starting with JFAC, including House leadership, and which is completely new on the Republican side this year. And I think there's like 39 overall brand new first-time rookie legislators. 39 out of 105 are brand new, have never done this before. And so change and uncertainty is really a theme as we get to know these new legislators, what they stand for, what they're passionate about, the kind of role that they want to play. So I think that a lot of the old assumptions we made about the legislature, we just don't know yet with all these new folks in there. And so we'll really have our hands full keeping an eye on this session very closely.
And then, Kevin, we have Representative Jack Nelson, who decided it was apparently a good idea to compare women's reproductive health care to cows. I mean, it usually takes a couple of weeks in the legislature before someone puts their foot in their mouth, but it only took a couple days this session.
Yeah, this was Tuesday, I believe. So it was early. And you're right, Representative Jack Nelson, first-term legislator from Jerome, made that pretty unfortunate comparison. What's interesting about this story, beyond the comment and the backlash, and you know, the fact that the comment went viral, which we could have pretty much predicted,
right?
I'm curious kind of about where it goes from here. Nelson has apologized. Recognize that it was probably not a good good comparison. And you know, what's interesting too is I think the political reaction to this and the political fallout to this might be different than what we've seen in the past. Because you're right, Gemma, we have these flare-ups every session where somebody says something that goes viral. And you know, there's usually, you know, a pretty swift and snarky response to it, and then it happens again. It's kind of rinse and repeat. What's different about this one, Gemma, is Nelson represents a very purple legislative district in Idaho. It's Legislative District 26, takes in Blaine County as well as parts of the Magic Valley. The other two lawmakers from that district are Democrats. Nelson won his race by 86 votes out of almost 16,000 votes cast in November. It was a race that, Clark will recall this, had been pretty much called for the Democrat in the race, but then there was some inconsistencies that came out in the vote tally that flipped the race on Thursday, 2 days after the election, to Nelson. So that's how narrow that election was. So Democrats really jumped on this, probably seeing this as an opportunity, probably seeing this as a winnable race in a winnable legislative district. So I think this is a little bit different. I mean, we've seen these kind of comments come out before. They usually come from Republicans in really conservative, really safely red legislative districts. It's a little bit different. And Nelson himself is a little bit different, Gemma. It's worth noting. He describes himself as one of not too many pro-choice Republicans in Idaho. So It's right. The politics here is a lot more interesting than just the comment itself.
Well, and in fact, Kevin, I mean, in his apology, I mean, he said, I absolutely respect women and the right to choose their own health care, unquote. And beyond that, I mean, during his campaign, I mean, he said that the government should not involve itself in abortion care. And so this comment was just, it came off so wrong and so flip and frankly, just so incredibly disrespectful to women, to people that have a uterus. There's no other way to say it.
No, it was definitely a bad comparison, bad metaphor, bad choice of words. And Nelson, apologized pretty quickly and pretty unconditionally. It wasn't one of those, I'm sorry if I offended anybody kind of apologies. It's like, yeah, I screwed up. I shouldn't have said this.
Right. No, agreed. Kalama, some news in regards to the Lori and Chad Daybell case, with Lori giving more information about the deaths of her children. Can you explain the latest?
Yeah, sure. So there are actually some new motions filed by both Lori and Chad's attorneys recently, including the one that you're asking about. Lori is saying that she was not present when her children, JJ and Tylee, were killed. She also says she was not present when Tammy Daybell, who was Chad's then wife, was killed or died. excuse me. So she says in the motion that she was at her home when JJ and Tylee died at her brother's apartment. And as you probably know, her brother has passed since as well. So what she's saying is basically she wasn't present. She knew about it at some point, but she was not present when they died. Because of this and some other issues, her attorney has requested that the death penalty be taken off the table for her.
And she also wants to meet with Chad, correct? And
yeah.
this is in regards to the fact, Columba, if I'm understanding this correctly, they are being tried together, but this request is coming from the attorneys, correct?
Yes. So yes, they are being tried together and they have not been in contact. According to Jim Archibald, who is Lori's attorney, they've spoken once since Chad was arrested in June 2020. And they want to be able to meet both via phone call and in person to discuss their defense options. If the motion is passed, both defense teams would be present at all meetings, but they would not be recorded because they are for defense planning.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point,
Kalama, the trial is scheduled for when?
So the trial right now is scheduled to begin this spring. I'm sorry, I don't recall the exact date, but another motion is actually requested that the trial be moved to April 2024. Because John Pryor, Chad's attorney, said that he needs more time to create a defense. He cited discovery materials have to be turned over by February 23rd from the prosecuting team to the defense team. And basically he's saying that there are less than 40 days there to create a defense in what could potentially be a death penalty trial. He wants a full another year to create a defense after receiving the discovery materials. So all of those motions, as well as a motion from the prosecution team to sequester the jury, are going to be heard by District Judge Stephen Boyce on January 19th. So the decision on those should be coming within the next week or so.
Okay. And those are some big things. So we'll be paying attention to that.
Yes.
Kevin, the other, I mean, case that is making national, international headlines, and this is the University of Idaho murders, four students killed in November. The man accused of killing the four had another court appearance yesterday. So what, if anything, came out of that?
Well, what did come out of it, and it was a very short court appearance, Brian Koberger waived his right to a speedy hearing. Under the law, he's supposed to have access. Any defendant is supposed to have a court hearing within 14 days. He waived that right. So what that basically means now is the preliminary hearing in this case, that won't happen until June 26th. And that signals that this is going to be a long legal process. But in some ways, it almost feels like that might be the best thing right now for Moscow and the best thing for the community, which has been under so much national scrutiny, international scrutiny. this feels like a community that has been in the fishbowl for the past couple of months, and especially these past few days as Koberg was arrested and returned to Idaho. Tonight we're going to see NBC's Dateline is going to dedicate its show to the Koberger case. And on ABC, 2020 is going to do its show on the Koberger case. And, you know, Nancy Grace has been in Moscow and has come under a lot of fire on social media for posting photos at the murder scene, for posting a selfie near the murder scene. She's getting a lot of criticism for just being, you know, insensitive, and she's deserved all of the criticism that she's gotten on social media over this. I think this community is probably at a point right now where they just want time to breathe, and they just want time to grieve. And now this is going to be a big story. It's going to be a big state story, a big local story. It's going to continue to get national attention. I think right now, a little breather in terms of the national coverage and the national news crews in Moscow would probably be welcome news to a lot of folks on the Palouse.
Right. And I think, too, Kevin, I mean, you're right. I mean, the selfies that Nancy Grace has posted have been outrageous.
I think, Gemma, what jumps out at me about that, too, on top of the fact that it's the crass insensitivity of it all,
right,
is that it really stands in conflict with what we've seen from state and local media on this. And, you know, I haven't been covering the criminal investigation or the court proceedings that closely. We cover education policy, and this is a human tragedy, and it's a crime story first and foremost. So we've stepped away from the coverage, but I think the Idaho Statesman's coverage has been spot on and sensitive. I think KTVB's coverage down here also, you know, very good, very sensitive, very, very compassionate, very understanding of this is a big story. We need to follow it. We need to keep people informed of it. But we also need to remember that four young adults died, brutally died, and this community, those who knew those victims and anybody who attends school there, teaches there, really anybody in the Moscow community has been profoundly affected by this. And I think, the local and state coverage, I give, major kudos to my colleagues on this. And when you have Nancy Grace, trot into town, set up a folding table outside a murder scene, it's really an insult to people who've been trying to do this right. And gives the media in general a black eye. And the sooner she leaves town, the better off for everybody.
I so agree with you, Kevin, because really, I mean, when you look at, you're so correct, I think, on the state and the local coverage of this. I mean, I think numerous stations, I mean, ours included, have stepped away unless there is a development that is like, okay, this is newsworthy. We will report on, the arrest of this individual. We will report on that he was in court, right? But you do it with sensitivity. And I mean, numerous journalists across the state have been asked to be on these programs, right? I stepped away from that as well because it was like, this is not doing any good. And when you see these national, and I'm quoting journalists, parachute in, it doesn't help. And, so many of us went to school up on the Palouse. It is a small town. These kids deserve to be able to go back to school this semester and maybe just try to have some normalcy. So moving that next court appearance to June allows all of these students, both at the University of Idaho and at WSU, to hopefully do the job of being college students.
I couldn't agree more. And I'll just quote one thing. This is a tweet from the Corner Club, a pretty well-known watering hole in Moscow. Quote, "We cannot wait for these vultures to leave so we as a community can begin to heal. They are disrupting that process and are not welcome." I mean, if you lose the bar owner in a college town, you've lost the room. That is, I think, pretty reflective of what I suspect is a lot of the sentiment up there.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. Before we take a quick break, I do want to turn gears completely. Rachel, you've been waiting patiently, and I want to bring you into the conversation. You wrote a really interesting story recently in regards to housing, and we know the need for housing in our community, how expensive it can be, but you really focused in on how this is impacting farm workers. What did you find out in your reporting?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've talked on your show so many times about housing and you know, the Treasure Valley's shortage of housing. I have yet to kind of touch on the farm worker housing issue, but, mm-hmm. We know that farm workers, require, often pretty affordable housing, because they often have large families and make around like $15 or so dollars an hour. So, you know, they definitely need stuff that's more on the affordable end. And just like everywhere else in the valley, that is really, on the short side, on the lacking side. People may have heard of Rudy Soto. He's the Idaho State Director of Rural Development for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He is a Nampa native. His father was a farm worker, so he lived in one of these like labor camp farm worker housing residences. And so he, with his knowledge of federal aid that's available through the Department of Agriculture, which we often don't think about as, the federal agency that, that supports housing, but they do have a lot of federal aid, grants, loans for nonprofits and other organizations to build housing specifically for farm workers and, also specifically rural housing. What Soto did is, kind of connect his local, some of the Canyon County housing providers or people concerned with farm worker housing to federal officials who kind of said, we can connect you to resources. So, he's really hoping that this roundtable that happened this week in Nampa will kind of be a starting point to help provide resources for agencies to provide housing. And one of the interesting things is, I think in Boise and other bigger cities in the Treasure Valley, we forget how many farm workers actually live and work in Idaho, but we are still like a very agriculture-centered state. So, and still surprisingly lacking some of these federal dollars that can be used for housing. So really interesting resources available through the Department of Agriculture.
Yeah. Kevin, is it a fair assessment to say that a Caldwell school board meeting went sideways earlier this week?
Probably a bit of an understatement. It was a very heated meeting that came to an abrupt end. We've talked before about how school board politics has become more strident and more divisive. I think we saw a really good example of that on Monday. Caldwell trustees were discussing a number of policies, one that would affect LGBTQ students and their rights. That policy came up for discussion. I believe there were about 13 people who spoke on the policy, 4 in favor, including 3 students. The rest of the speakers were against it. Pretty tense meeting that became extremely tense when Chris Traikel, a newly elected state senator from Caldwell, took to the podium, said that Caldwell should drop this policy before even taking it further, that the district is going to get sued if they implement this policy. He and the chair of the board, Maricela Piscina, kind of got into a bit of a confrontation. Moments later, Piscina adjourned the meeting. There was a motion on the on the floor to adjourn the meeting, and the board did adjourn. I think it's just an illustration of something that, like I say, we've talked about before. School board policies, school board politics has really gone on steroids the past couple of years with these hot button issues, whether you're talking about COVID response, concerns about whether schools are engaging in critical race theory, you name it. You get into this policy, which would, among other things, allow students to use locker rooms aligning with their gender identity. You get into policies like this, you get into this sort of unfortunate and really ugly discourse when, you know, this is a serious topic that deserves serious and, you would hope, sober consideration, and that really did not happen on Monday night. We have a story about it, and we link to the video of the meeting. So if you're curious about how it all happened and how it all went down, you can see it for yourself.
And Kevin, what about the, I know you mentioned the lawmaker who stood up and said, I'm in my official capacity. I mean, it was surprising, but not surprising that someone would do that.
Yeah, and I think it's also maybe reflective of a lot of the new, maybe more strident conservatism we're seeing at the legislature. Trakel is one of a number of, you know, more far-right conservative senators who were elected that last election cycle. We haven't even seen him in action at the State House yet. But, you know, this on the first, you know, on Monday, which was also happened to be the first day of the legislative session, he was at this board meeting. And, you know, this whole thing transpired. You know, I think it's reflective of, you know, state politics to some degree, as well as school board politics.
Right. Yeah. So, Rachel, we've known that the West Ada School District, which is the largest school district in the state, has continued to grow really at tremendous levels. And now you've got some numbers on how overcrowded some of these schools are. And the one thing that stood out to me was Oahe High School. This is a brand new high school built in 2020, and they're already over capacity or will be next year.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you that that's what stuck out to me too. And I think that just shows how, you know, it seems that they're building schools kind of after they've reached that point where they need them, you know, because obviously Oahe High School, if it's already over capacity or expected to be over capacity next school year, the school year after that, you know, it shows that it has been needed probably long before it actually was built. So yeah, I'm definitely lately I've been interested in kind of school overcrowding. Last time I was on the show, I talked about the Valley View School District issue, and West Ada's is, you know, a little bit less intense than some other districts like CUNA and Valley View, but they still are facing, you know, a lot of overcrowding in the next few years, especially in the high schools. You know, looking at the elementary schools, they look like they're pretty much gonna work. Middle schools, you know, a little bit over capacity, but their high schools are just, you know, hundreds over capacity. And so, you know, the conversation that the West Ada folks had with the Meridian City Council, they didn't bring up any needs or, you know, any funding questions yet, but they're supposed to meet next month, you know, to have those conversations about if they want to try another bond, you know, what they're seeing in the legislature with funding. You know, this is kind of an ongoing conversation, and I'm sure the legislature reporters can, you know, will fill us in if there's anything related to, you know, school funding that happens in the legislature. But I think that's what, you know, a lot of people are watching.
Well, and speaking of school funding, Kevin, let's talk about the issue of not enough students in Idaho going on to some type of higher education after high school, and what the governor is now proposing and already getting some pushback from Republican lawmakers about this idea.
Well, there's already some pushback, and I think you may see more of that, to his proposal to put $80 million into scholarships that high school graduates could use for two-year college, four-year college, career technical education, workforce training. It's a pretty versatile scholarship as he's laid it out. It's also by far the largest scholarship that we would have in state government. I think we're offering about $30 million of scholarships total. This would be $80 million. I wrote a piece on Thursday that looked at that and tried to get a better sense of how this would work. And I asked a series of fairly I thought, fairly basic logistical questions about how this scholarship would be structured. The governor's office is saying that they're still kind of working on a lot of details. And yeah, these are basic details like, is this a reimbursement scholarship? I mean, and, you know, are you just going to reimburse the cost for a student to get a CTE certificate or workforce training, which would not be that maximum scholarship that we're talking about of $8,500. You know, would students be able to take the scholarship after they take a gap year or serve a church mission or go to the military? Would students be able to get this scholarship, this $8,500 scholarship, and also get one of the state's opportunity scholarships that's available for college students? These are questions that the governor's office is not answering at this point. So it's early in the session, I'll grant that. But, you know, this was a big proposal that came out of the State of the State Address, really one of the big surprises that came out of the State of the State Address. We'll keep asking questions, and we'll keep trying to get answers about how this thing would work.
Kalama, I want to head back over to you and to East Idaho, because the Bingham County coroner is heading to trial. What's going on there?
Yes, sorry. So the recently elected Bingham County coroner, James Roberts, was charged last year with a misdemeanor for sexual battery. Because it is a misdemeanor, court documents are kind of limited as far as information. But what we do know is that last April, he grabbed a woman's breast against her will, basically. And he was charged with the misdemeanor for sexual battery. He appeared last week in court, or 2 weeks ago in court, and pled not guilty. So the case will be going to trial in March.
Okay. I want to spend these last couple of minutes, if we can, in the show, reflecting on a true journalistic icon here in Idaho, and that's Betsy Russell. Betsy retired recently, and she has been covering the Idaho legislature, I think, for going on 40 years. And I know Kevin and Clark, both of you cover the Idaho legislature. You've been covering it with Betsy for years. You know, even when I moved to Boise in 1999 to start the Fox 12 station, you know, Betsy was this icon, right? And I think I've just always been in awe of not just her journalistic integrity, but how she was able to cover so much. And so I'm curious, with the two of you, you know, your thoughts on all of the time you were able to work with her in the legislature, but what's it like being there this first week of the session and Betsy isn't there? And so Clark, I'll start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the end of an era. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. Betsy's covered the Idaho legislature, Idaho government, Idaho politics for 37 years. She worked for three important newspapers in her career, the Idaho Statesman, the Spokesman Review, and most recently the Idaho Press. And her column, The Eye on Boise, was essentially required reading for anyone interested in the legislature, and quite frankly, anyone trying to make heads or tails of the legislature. Once you get into mid-session and late session, there's just so much going on. It's so difficult to keep track of. But Betsy had this knack for being able to cover multiple meetings at once, using the online streaming services and recording some meetings and all of her sources. But her Eye on Boise blog was really required reading for generations now of Idahoans and of Idaho political leaders. I mean, one of the things I thought was really telling, I did a story in December to kind of coincide with her retirement, which started on January 1st. And I called up more than a dozen current and former political figures in the state of Idaho. Everyone wanted to talk to me. Everyone, except for Wayne Hoffman of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, had something very nice to say about Betsy. I talked to former Governor Butch Otter. I talked to U.S. Senator Jim Risch. I talked to Lieutenant Governor Scott Bedke. And everybody talked about how fair and ethical she was as a journalist. And, you know, it's the end of an era. It's really weird being in the State House press office and not having Betsy around, but I know she's excited to spend her weekdays skiing up at Bogus Basin. But on Wednesday of this week, there was a retirement reception for Betsy in downtown Boise. The governor was there, the Speaker of the House was there. There were probably 100 people there that came out to pay tribute to Betsy. And we're not going to see another Betsy. We're not going to see another reporter like her. And just one other thing, on Tuesday, U.S. Representative Mike Simpson stood up on the floor of Congress and gave a speech commemorating Betsy and honoring her career. And that's permanently in the congressional record now. And so just a couple of cool things this week between Representative Simpson's speech on the U.S. House floor and then her retirement reception on Wednesday night. But certainly the end of an era, and we'll never see another Betsy. And I'll give Kevin the last word, because I know he's worked with her for even longer than I have.
And I want to take it in a different direction. On top of Betsy's journalistic accomplishments, which are well known, and a well established, and Clark's profile that he wrote a couple of weeks ago really chronicled that, and the impact that she had on policymakers as a journalist, that's well established. But I want to make sure that we don't forget that Betsy was a tireless advocate for open government, for transparency. Yeah. She was a longtime president of the Idaho Press Club, kind of longtime leader of IDOG, Idahoans for Openness in Government. She is an advocate for openness in government that likes, I've never seen anybody as tireless and passionate and as eloquent about the need for transparency in government. And, I think as journalists, we're all going to have to step up to the plate and try to channel our inner Betsy and speak for that. And the other thing that I don't want people to lose sight of on Betsy was that she really supported other journalists as they were coming up, and journalists as they were, taking different career paths. I saw that 10 years ago when we launched Idaho Education News. A lot of people were like, what are Clark and Kevin and Jennifer Swindell doing over there? What the heck is this thing? Betsy got it. She supported it right away, and I will owe her a debt of gratitude for that. She leaves a lot for us as journalists to try to step up and emulate. And Godspeed to her in her retirement, and we will try to carry the torch here.
Yeah, and I have to say, how she supports other journalists. I mean, I remember being so intimidated by her, right? Because she was just, it felt like she could be at five places at once covering the legislature. And here I was, this 20-something-year-old kid, basically. And I remember, being so nervous to even approach her, because I was like, she's going to think I'm an idiot, right? Like,
she is about the most approachable person you'd ever want to meet. I mean, she's got time to answer questions and help people out. That's part of her legacy, and it doesn't get as much attention as it deserves. So I wanted to give her a shout out for that as well.
Yeah, it is such a loss, but we are so excited that she's retiring, and I actually hope she's up at Bogus Basin right now. I want to thank all of you for coming on this Friday. Big thanks to Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Rachel Spotcheck with the Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, and our own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, along with Kalama Hines, reporter with EastIdahoNews.com. Give all of these folks a follow, and we've just got some really phenomenal journalists out there. So I want to thank all of you for your time.
Thank you
so much. Thank you, Gemma.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed, because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to LifeKit from NPR.